was Elephant Bill, and how did he become a World War II hero? Vicki Constantine Croak will join us to talk about her new book, Elephant Company, the inspiring story of an unlikely hero and the animals who helped him save lives in World War II.
He was really disgusted by the process of cadaring. He was disgusted by the fact that baby elephants were left to die, and he wanted to change that.
Just how much do genes determine our lives? David Dobbs will be here to talk about his review this week of two books, A Troublesome Inheritance by Nicholas Wade and Inheritance, How Our Genes Change Our Lives and Our Lives Change Our Genes by Sharon Mualim.
Well, Wade is arguing that races are biologically based in genetic differences that actually create differences in social behavior.
The New York Times has a new publishing reporter. I'll talk to Alexandra Alter about her take on the industry and what she sees as publishing's next big stories. And Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Vicki Constantine Croak joins us now. Her new book is called Elephant Company, the inspiring story of an unlikely hero and the animals who helped him save lives in World War II. Hi, Vicki.
Hello, Pamela.
So the book, is reviewed on the cover this week by Sarah Gruen, author of Water for Elephants, among other novels. So this is quite a tale that you tell here. Who was Billy Williams?
Billy Williams was an animal lover his whole life. He served in World War I, and he wanted to have more adventures. And he went off to Burma specifically to live his life with elephants. He worked for the teak companies in the logging camps taking care of elephants. What's interesting is that I think in our modern conception of how elephants should be, it feels a little painful to think about elephants doing that kind of work. Ultimately, the logging business has saved the elephants of Burma. And I just talked to Alan Rabinowitz, an expert in big cats in Myanmar, and he said absolutely that the working elephants have been saved. So Burma today has the second largest population of Asian elephants in the world. But back to J.H. Williams, he fell in love with elephants, and one of the most important things to me in deciding to do this book is that he loved them. He fought for their humane care. He took care of them. He basically became an elephant veterinarian. And he felt that elephants taught him how to be a better man. When World War II broke out, he led the only company of elephants for the Allied forces and, in fact, had this amazing adventure, twice helping refugees escape Burma to India. And the second escape was a huge adventure in which they traveled over five mountain ranges between Burma and India.
Going back to the role of elephants in Burma, or today called Myanmar, elephants have been used in the logging industry in Thailand, in Burma, for a long time, right before Billy Williams, who I guess was known as Elephant Bill, came into it. But he made some changes in terms of how he treated the elephants. What did he do?
He was horrified to find out that the way elephants joined the ranks of the Bombay Burma Teak Corporation was that they were captured when they were in their late teens, and a really horrible strategy called cadaring. They would funnel wild elephants and scare them into corrals and then basically beat them, starve them, leave them out in the sun until they were, as he said, heartbroken. Lots of them died during this process. When they were completely broken animals, they were trained to work in the logging business. In the meantime, baby elephants who were born to the working mothers, we should say here that working elephants are half working elephants and half wild elephants. They would go into the forest at night on their own and interact with wild elephants and forage for themselves. So very often they would mate not only among one another, but with wild elephants. So the logging companies had lots of baby elephants, but they had an even higher mortality rate than the wild elephants because their mothers were forced to continue working when they should have been taking care of their babies. And so Elephant Bill thought to himself, why are we doing... He was really disgusted by the process of cadaring. He was disgusted by the fact that baby elephants were left to die, and he wanted to change that, but he knew the only way he could change the minds of the people who ran the logging company was to prove to them that it would be more economical to save those babies, to raise them and put them in elephant school so that they would learn how to be logging elephants. And he did just that. He showed that it made more sense financially to save the babies and to not capture wild ones.
This was a British teak company, but had this process existed before the British came to Burma? Was this something that had been going on for a long time?
Kadaring had been going on forever, and that's in ancient texts talk about kadaring and how to do it. The gentling process really was thought up by a wonderful Burmese elephant man named Potok. And he had come up with the concept of gentling elephants. And fortunately, two lives came together. Potok and Elephant Bill met each other at the very beginning of Elephant Bill's career. And he was fascinated by Potok's mastery. He was a master mahout, his mastery over the elephants, and his concept of how being kind to elephants would actually benefit the logging company.
It sounds a lot like parenting children. It was all about positive reinforcement, right?
Exactly.
And encouragement. So what happens when the Japanese invade Burma in 1942?
It totally took the country by surprise. No one was prepared for it. And I have to say that Burma was not considered, India was the jewel in the crown. And Burma was kind of an outpost that was a second thought. When the Japanese invaded, they really were unprepared, and it led to people suddenly had to, Westerners and Indians had come over and were hired by the British in civil service jobs and other kinds of businesses. So, in fact, in Rangoon at that time, Indians made up something like 53% of the population of the city. When the Japanese came, all the Westerners and the Indian population, they suddenly had to leave the country. So something like 600,000 people evacuated Burma, which had no infrastructure. It's considered that something like 80,000 people may have died during that evacuation.
And what happened with Williams's elephant school and his troops?
He had no time initially to do very much at all but get out himself and he tried to get some of the elephants out, but he snuck back in. He was part of the army took him on. They made him an elephant advisor, as he said, before they had any elephants in their ranks. So he came back into Burma before the British troops came back in after everyone had gone, and he set about gathering elephants to make his own little army.
And what did this elephant company do during the war?
It's interesting. Initially, the people in the army thought what they'd do is be transport animals. But Elephant Bill knew that what they were really best at was building what he called elephant bridges. And because Burma had very few roads or bridges, it was very difficult for the army to get around in the monsoon season, impossible. And he knew what the elephants could do was make those bridges in order for the army vehicles to be able to move. And one of the biggest contributions they made was not only making all those little bridges, but something called a Bailey Bridge was used by the Army at that time. It was brand new, and it was lightweight bridging material. And because the elephants had made so many of the smaller bridges, the Bailey bridging material could be saved for some of the bigger rivers that they needed them for. And that was considered by some historians a major factor in winning the war in Burma.
And I don't want to give away the full story, even though, of course, it's part of the historic record. But there's an attempted escape and a big adventure having to do with the border into India. But what, I'm curious, made you decide to look into this story? Billy Williams, as you point out, had written more than one memoir. What led you to revisit his story?
After I finished The Lady and the Panda, which came out in 2005, I really loved writing that book, and I wanted something similar. I wanted to find an adventure story where a person saved animal or animals and fell in love with them and taught us something about that species.
Wait, so just to interrupt you for a minute, I reviewed that book for the Book Review back in 2005, but for listeners who are not familiar with that story, just briefly, what was The Lady and the Panda about?
The Lady and the Panda was the improbable story of a dress designer and socialite who brought the first giant panda back to the United States in 1936.
So you were in that period and looking at, you know, relationships between people and animals. And then how did you come across Billy Williams?
I was leafing through a book about elephants, and I saw this tiny illustration of an elephant high up on a cliff overlooking a valley, and the caption said, J.H. Williams escapes from Burma with his elephants in 1943. And I had that same kind of sensation when I first heard about Ruth Harkness. I thought, what is that story about? And that's what led me to start to look him up. And it, just like Ruth Harkness, there were, in this case, he had many more memoirs, but I thought the story, first of all, has been forgotten, and I don't think it's been completely told.
And you kind of came across a treasure trove of research material while looking into this. What happened? You went to Tasmania.
Yes, I found J.H. Williams' surviving son, Treve, who's living in, he's a racehorse veterinarian, an international racehorse veterinarian living in Tasmania. So I contacted him, and I could never understand from talking to him or emailing with him how much archival material he still had. And I thought, I've just got to go there and see. So I traveled to Tasmania, actually one of my favorite places on earth. Last time I went, I thought, it's too bad I'll never see this place again. But here I got my second trip to Tasmania. And Treve brought out a small suitcase of material for me to use of his father's. So I was a little disappointed when I saw how small the suitcase was. But we had dinner and scotch. And the next morning when I came back to Treve's house, now there was a giant trunk set out with all kinds of material, movie scripts, letters, writings that J.H. Williams had done on elephants that was never published.
That was good scotch.
It was great scotch.
And did this become a movie?
There were many attempts to make this into a movie over time in the 1950s, mm-hmm. and actors who were considered for it include Gary Cooper, Humphrey Bogart, and Ernest Borgnine.
So when you were researching it, did you then go to Myanmar to revisit these places?
I did not get to Myanmar. One thing, I set up two important goals. One was to get there, but the most important thing to me was to understand elephants intimately. So I not only had my trip to Tasmania, but there are two Asian elephants here in Massachusetts that I was given basically unrestricted access to, Emily and Ruth, and I thought, I need to know elephants in an intimate way. I need to know what they smell like and sound like. I knew everything from books about elephants, but I really felt that I needed that tactile connection with elephants. I needed to see how their minds work. I needed them to recognize me and me to recognize them, and that to me was the heart of telling J.H. Williams' story.
What did you discover through this connection with elephants?
They're so wise and intelligent. I saw that at work all the time, and I saw their sense of humor, which was important to Williams. I discovered funny little things, like when you pet an elephant, you have to avert your eyes because they're always bathing themselves in sand. And so when you're petting an elephant, it's raining down on you at the time. But the bigger issues are how close their bonds are with either the elephants around them or the people and what they'll do for them and the attachments that they form. I could see that. I had a little bit of it for myself, and I experienced some really funny moments, like when they can open a coconut, which is one of their favorite foods. They'll put their foot over it and smash it, but they know it'll pop like a balloon, so they put their foot over the coconut and they turn their head the other way and close their eyes and then pop it.
How did you see evidence of the sense of humor?
One, the coconut, but also they do, they will make jokes. There's an elephant keeper at the Buttonwood Park Zoo where Emily and Ruth are. And Ruth in particular, if there were a lampshade big enough, Ruth would wear it. She is the joker of the two elephants there. They'll play games with their keepers, either fetching sticks, or one of the keepers who really gentled Ruth. She was brought there as a dangerous elephant, and she's now a lap elephant. And the man who caused that turnaround, Bill Sampson, whenever he comes in, she runs over to him. And I have a video of him talking to a crowd of people, and she's basically like a little kid making faces behind him. She's right behind him and moving her trunk around to tickle him.
Has Billy Williams' son, Treve, read the book?
He has.
What was his response to it?
He made me cry. He was so happy about the book. And some of the things that he said to me were so dear. Treve is a very earthy guy and very funny. And one of the things that he thought was that the book just didn't have enough sex in it.
Okay. All right. Well, if you're looking for sex, Elephant Company may not be the book for you. But there's a lot of other great things in there. Vicki Constantine-Croke, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Pamela.
The book again is Elephant Company, the inspiring story of an unlikely hero and the animals who helped him save lives in World War II. I'm joined now by Alexandra Alter, who is our new publishing reporter. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi.
So you are coming in replacing Julie Bosman, who our listeners know well, who has moved on to the Midwest, and you're coming from the Wall Street Journal. What did you cover at the Journal?
So I was at the Journal for 7 years, and for the past 5 years, I've been writing about books and culture for the Friday Arts and Culture section, really looking at big trends in publishing, the rise of self-publishing and fan fiction, the rise of YA and YA movie franchises, and how adults are picking up on YA and middle grade and those kinds of all the sort of, you know, the big trends that are happening in publishing now, as well as kind of e-reading and how we're reading now.
And did you write profiles as well? Or
yes, that's one of my favorite things about the job. I mean, first of all, getting all the books is incredible. When I started writing about books, my husband said, it's like you got a huge raise because
right.
we're not going to be spending so much money on books. But no, I loved, loved getting all the books and meeting authors. I wrote profiles of Don DeLillo and Stephen King and just people that I've been reading for years. And so it's always fun to sit down and see, you know, where they get their ideas, what makes them tick.
Who's been your favorite person to profile?
I would have to say Stephen King was amazing. He's so personable. And, you know, I started reading him when I was way too young to even be reading him, maybe like 8 or 9, staying up really late.
Reading Carrie late into the night.
Exactly. So we got to meet at his house, which was, you know, unusual. He's pretty private, actually. And, you know, he talked about his dogs and we had cinnamon buns and he was just very friendly, sort of casual, profane, you know. Looking at his books was interesting. He's like, he reads everything, as I'm sure you know, he reviews for you. So
you also started a book club at the Journal.
Yes, that was a really fun thing, and it's ongoing. And right now, Neil Gaiman is the host, and he picked James Thurber's 13 Clock. So the concept there is that we would bring in an author to choose their favorite book and talk to them about how it influenced them, and they could sort of pick it apart from a professional standpoint and pose questions. And, you know, there's a ton of members now, and it's going really well, so I'm proud of that.
All right, enough about the Journal.
Yes.
What are you looking forward to story-wise at the Times? Are there particular trends that are going on now that interest you?
You know, one of the fun things about the way books are covered here is that, it's really something – the big trends are happening. It's like the intersection of business and technology and culture. And so I'm really excited at looking at some of the new multimedia approaches to books. Like Google is getting into kind of interactive novels and games, and I think that'll be an interesting thing to follow. So I'm, you know, excited about looking at the continuing rise of young adult fiction. I don't know if you saw Publishers Weekly release their bestsellers of the year so far this week. And I think the top 9 out of 10 titles were young adult and middle grade. So that's just something that's continuing to happen.
Right. At least someone's continuing to read. And,
yes.
And good thing it's young people.
Exactly.
It's not an aging field.
Yeah. And I'm just excited. This fall, there are so many incredible books coming out. I spent the last few weeks reading David Mitchell's The Bone Clocks, which was amazing. And I finished Joseph O'Neill's The Dog, which is coming out. And it's set in Dubai, which I thought was such a brilliant setting for fiction. It's such a weird, you know, a weird place.
What are the other fall books that you are sort of keeping an eye on?
I'm excited about the Hilary Mantel collection of short stories. I just think she's an absolute genius. And so, you know, I've read her novels and I'm excited to see what she does with short fiction. And another book that I just finished that is really unlike anything I've ever read is called The Book of Strange New Things by Michelle Faber.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of actually captures this trend that I've been noticing recently in publishing where there's just this real blurring of genre lines.
Mm-hmm.
This novel is, I mean, you couldn't really call it science fiction even though it's entirely set on another planet. It's about this, you know, a marriage and sort of the complications of a marriage. And it's about the loss of faith. And it's really kind of a literary novel with really amazing aliens in it.
Are there particular genres or kinds of books that you gravitate towards as a reader?
You know, one of the really fun things about covering the industry is that I've had to stretch a lot, and I actually really enjoy that. I mean, before I was writing about books, I was sort of gravitated towards literary fiction and mostly novels or kind of narrative nonfiction. But now I've started reading a lot of crime fiction, science fiction, occasionally romance. And, you know, it's interesting when you pick up something that you wouldn't read sort of recreationally by choice, you can sort of look for the things that are pulling people through it and figure out why it's popular. And that's sort of an interesting thing, too. But I found that there's a lot of good crime fiction. So that's fun.
And your role here obviously extends sort of from culture across technology and into business. Looking at the publishing industry, are there in sort of larger industry trends that you're keeping an eye on?
Yeah, I mean, as far as the business goes, you know, obviously the big story right now is the conflict between Amazon and Hachette, and that's ongoing. And other publishers' contracts are coming up for negotiation in the fall, so it'll be interesting to see how they fare when they have to negotiate with Amazon.
Do we know which one is next up to bat?
I actually don't know that. That's a good question.
All right. Well, I'm sure you will find out for us.
And then, you know, you're seeing increasing consolidation, of course. You know, Penguin Random House was this latest massive merger to take place. And then recently, you know, there have been some other consolidations. And then I'm noticing within, you know, big imprints, there's just this building out more of like creating new imprints, specific ones, giving editors their own imprints. And so it's sort of like a combination of these companies are getting bigger and more powerful and more consolidated, but they're also creating these more targeted lists and sort of, you know, maintaining a very diverse, you know, list of books and producing more titles. So,
all right. Well, lots more to come from Alexander Alter, who I'm sure will be a regular guest on the podcast. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
David Dobbs joins us now. He reviews two books this week about genes. The first, A Troublesome Inheritance, Genes, Race, and Human History by Nicholas Wade, and Inheritance, How Our Genes Change Our Lives and Our Lives Change Our Genes by Sharon Mualim. David, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
So these are two, despite the title similarity, very, very different books. Let's talk first about the Nicholas Wade book, which has been getting a lot of attention. What is Nicholas Wade's thesis in this book? What's he arguing?
Well, Wade is arguing first that it's time to talk about something that he thinks and argues is clear, that races are biologically based in genetic differences, and that the different races, he talks about three major races, have genetic differences that actually create differences in social behavior, and that this accounts for their different positions and fates and struggles in the modern world. It is a very provocative argument. He recognizes that. He admits that and tries to address that in various ways. But in the end, it's striking many people, including me, as a bit circular. He doesn't have a lot to draw on in terms of the genetic basis for these differences, so he has to basically assert that there are differences and that some of those differences, though we can't point to them, are key in generating different behaviors. And we know that this is so because we behave differently, and therefore we behave differently because of genetic differences. But he can never actually point to the differences that create the behaviors, so it becomes a highly speculative circular argument.
Mm-hmm. So he's basically attempting a kind of mismeasure of man here.
That's a good point. I think it's really important to note that this goes back. This is what some folks call scientific racism, and it has a pretty long history running back at least 150 years into the mid-19th century, and it's what led about 100 years ago to the eugenics movement. There's a gentleman named Charles Davenport who was at Harvard, who stressed that there were key differences, inherent differences between the races, and that we needed to protect ourselves as a nation against sort of a decrease in our ability by intermixing. And he actually wished for a wall that would keep out these inferior races. It was not an innocent idea, and it was not a safe idea. It led in fairly direct fashion to the sterilization of tens of thousands of people, and that body of work was drawn on by Nazi Germany to kind of form its whole eugenics program, which included killing 6 million Jews, a million of which were children, along with tens of thousands of people who were mentally disabled and or homosexual. Wade argues that it's safe to bring this up now. So there are two assertions he gives for bringing this up now. One is that we're sort of over racism enough. The opposition to racism is deeply entrenched enough that it's safe to talk about this, and that the evidence from modern genetics is strong enough that it's time we confront it. I don't think, and many population genetists don't think, either of those is a plausible argument.
Let's just go back to the history, because it doesn't end there, and he ends up drawing on more recent efforts by historians and social sciences. The one that leaps first to mind is Charles Murray's book. You know, what does he say about books by Murray and Francis Fukuyama and Niall Ferguson, and how does he build his argument based on their ideas?
Yeah, this is one of the oddities of the book, and I think one of its weaknesses is Wade is arguing that he says that our discussion about race and genetics has been constrained by politics.
Political correctness.
Political correctness, in a word, or two words. Yet he himself draws heavily on a body of work that most people see as conservative. So one is economic historian Gregory Clark, who talks about how the British Empire rose because the English rich outbred the English poor and embedded their superior genes throughout the nation. He also draws on Francis Fukuyama and notions that Western culture represents a sort of peak right now. And he draws on Charles Murray a bit in his examination of IQ differences among different races.
Is he critical at all of Murray, or does he support what Murray was saying in his book, The Bell Curve?
He doesn't lean as heavily on Murray as he might, mm-hmm. as one might expect. He builds his argument more around these views of history that tend to look at economic forces and downplay the influence of political power and huge historical events like slavery, the dominance of Europe militarily over much of the world over the last 500 years. So they tend to set those aside as explanations for, you know, the different states of cultures in the different parts of the world right now, and emphasize what they see as traits of economic behavior. Mm-hmm. So how much do you cooperate in a market economy, that sort of thing? How much do you trust other people outside your immediate ilk? A key event in Wade's view is, and he's drawing on some of these same historians here, but he cites Europe's adoption starting about 1,000 years ago of the principle that law is the ultimate ruler. It's mm-hmm. greater than any person or office that rules. And once this was done, Wade says, since people could depend on law to settle disputes about property and so on, that allowed a transition from a closed, insular, tribal social organization that were common all over the world to more open, interactive nation states. And this, in turn, he says, let Europe and the Caucasian cultures enter a sort of self-reinforcing cycle in which a trade-oriented, rules-based culture selected for gene variants that generated more trusting and productive social behavior.
He looks at Caucasians, he looks at East Asians, he looks at Sub-Saharan Africans as these three major groups, these three major races, and says that their genes in relation to the law evolved in very different ways, that the Europe became a kind of rules-based, trade-oriented culture. The East Asians evolved to what?
Well, the East Asians, he argues, were also extremely rules-based,
right,
but had a more rigid, authoritarian culture that was less open to trading outside and less open, especially to innovation.
The Sub-Saharan Africans?
He sees them as still trapped largely in sort of tribal levels of trust and cooperation.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot that this overlooks, that
right.
Wade's arguments overlook. Even if you buy his characterization of these cultural differences, he still faces a huge problem, which is showing that they are based in genetics. This is his argument, that they are based in genetics and that genetics account for the momentum of different cultures.
I mean, you're saying in your review, you compare this to, you know, how the tiger got his stripes kind of stories. It sounds like the studies that he uses to back up these contentions are in themselves faulty, and that his recitation of the studies, the faulty studies, are also incomplete.
He has very little to draw on. He actually says at one point that we can't yet point with confidence to the genes that create greater trust among Caucasians, yet we know they must be there because there's greater trust. This is essentially his argument, and that is a just-so story and a circular argument, both at once.
Let's just talk about the second part of Wade's argument, which is to say that his assertion that it's now okay to talk about all of this. What is he saying?
He disposes of that quite briefly. The language, if I remember it correctly, is that it's safe now because opposition to racism is so deeply embedded in at least Western society. I find that, as someone who's paying attention to what goes on in the world, a fairly ambitious or wild statement. I don't think we're quite over the whole racism thing, and there's plenty in the daily news that shows us it's not. We are hardly over racial differences, and it's still an explosive thing to talk about. Now, if the facts are so overwhelmingly clear, if it's really clear that we do need to talk about this as a genetic thing, then perhaps we do. But again, he doesn't have that sort of evidence. I'm frankly puzzled by the assertion that it's now safe to talk or productive to talk about it. I think it's destructive to talk about it unless you are really well armed and the evidence is extraordinary, and
right.
The evidence is actually extraordinarily weak or basically not there.
All right, let's go to the second book. Nicholas Wade is a science journalist, longtime writer for the New York Times. Sharon Mualim, author of Inheritance, How Our Genes Change Our Lives and Our Lives Change Our Genes, the second book you review here, is a medical doctor. What's his book about?
Well, yes, he's a medical doctor, and he both researches and treats rare genetic diseases.
Mm-hmm.
So he is coming at genetics in a very different way. What he writes about and what he sees in his practice are two things. One, small little mutations, accidental defects in the DNA of people who would otherwise be healthy, but that make big differences and cause some really strange diseases, but that we're only beginning to figure them out. I mean, so many of the cases he's getting are novel. They're new to him, or they've known about them, and they're still trying to penetrate the first layer, the first veil that's hiding why that gene causes what it does.
Right. From what I understand it, when a parent has a child and they know that it might be something genetic, they don't know sort of the child might have delays or difficulties or differences, and it sort of seems inexplicable, it's now common to say, well, they think it's something genetic. But it's very hard to test for these things because the knowledge isn't quite there, and there are so many possibilities. Does he talk about some of these rare genetic aberrations and sort of where we are in figuring them out?
Yes, he does, and most of them were very early in figuring them out. For instance, there's one he talks about that makes there's a little girl who is impervious to pain.
Right.
Now, this happens now and then. This is not unheard of. I mean, you hear about it because it does happen now and then. And it's so strange that you should be impervious to pain. There was a young man in India, I believe it was, that made a living out of being impervious to pain. He would do things that, you know, like stick pins through his skin and jump off of things and do stuff that everyone could recognize would hurt, and then collect money for it. And he ended up dying of this. So you do hear of these things. And this was traced to a gene called SCN9A. The value of this is recognizing first, okay, this is what's causing this particular case,
mm-hmm.
so that we can rule out other stuff. And the other is that by researching what is downstream from this gene, you can start to learn a lot about how pain works. So in this case, this gene affects ion channels in cells that transmit pain messages. The message is sort of erased on the way to the brain, which is why you never know that when you slam your finger in the door, it actually should hurt.
Right.
There's another one he looks at that causes a really weird disease that fuses a person's bones so that over their lifetime they slowly become encased in this sort of fused skeleton and have more and more trouble moving the back of your ribs, for instance, is all becomes kind of one webby mass that's no longer flexible.
Right.
And again, this is something that they are so early in understanding. Now they've identified the gene. They still don't know what to do about it.
Right.
And what Moalem's book points to, and he has some hopes for, is that the field of epigenetics might help people like him figure out how to treat some of these other genetic diseases. So in one case, you have these mutations. It's an actual change in the genetic code. But another field that has been exploding over the last 10 or 15 years and getting a lot of attention is called epigenetics, which is a muddy term, but basically it means differences in how active your genes are. So genes turn on and off. This is not brand new news,
right,
but it's getting more attention, and it's why you go through all the changes you go through in your life. But in some cases, the hope is, Moalem says, that they can learn how to manipulate genes expression, not rewrite the code, but get existing genes in a person to behave differently to counteract some of these diseases. He's quick to recognize that that's down the road, and in a way, that's what I like about this book, is it's weirdly, horrifyingly, but entertainingly clear, and that both these fields, our understanding of genetics, is in a very, very early stage.
Inheritance is not as overtly a political book as Nicholas Wade's A Troublesome Inheritance, but there is epigenetics. That field has a kind of murky history. Could you talk a little bit about that and about sort of why it seems now we're thinking more positively about epigenetics and what we can learn from it?
Its controversy is not of the sort of political sort that Wade has courted. The question on epigenetics, first of all, is what exactly is it? Because people use the term differently. One big point of argument among geneticists is, let's say something in my life changes some of the controls on my genetic expression, things like, with technical terms, like methylation, which is basically a little cap that goes on a gene that makes sure that gene will stay silent. Okay, this happens in various conditions, and Moalem writes about how trauma, for instance, appears to change the methylation in some genes that affect neurotransmitters in children who are traumatized. Okay, now there's two questions that are outstanding. How reversible is it in that person?
Right.
Would good psychotherapy, for instance, unmethylate that gene so that it could still operate normally, as it were? The other question is, how transferable is that methylation change to the offspring? Epigenetics, heritable. And that is a very hot topic. There is some evidence that it is.
Right.
There is a lot of feeling among many geneticists that evidence has been overstressed, overemphasized, and that to the degree it happens, it's a rare thing. So this is something that really needs to be worked out, and there remains, you know, almost fighting words among certain corners of the genetics community is whether epigenetics is sort of getting, as Richard Dawkins asserts, it's 15 minutes of fame, or whether it will grow into something that both teaches us a lot about how the genome works and opens the way to therapies for all kinds of things, whether they're physical problems or mental health issues.
All right. Well, some answers, a lot of questions raised by these two books. The books, again, are A Troublesome Inheritance, Genes, Race, and Human History by Nicholas Wade, and Inheritance, How Our Genes Change Our Lives and Our Lives Change Our Genes by Sharon Moalem, both reviewed this week by David Dobbs. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on the list?
There are four new titles on the hardcover fiction list this week. Starting with number 16, Jacqueline Winspear, who is well known for her Maisie Dobbs mystery series, has a standalone novel called The Care and Management of Lies, new at number 16. Like the Maisie Dobbs series, The Care and Management of Lies is set around World War I. It's about a farm wife who has to kind of learn to take care of the homestead when her husband goes off to war.
It's interesting how with the centenary, there's a lot of fiction, too, dealing with World War I
themes. Yeah, in fact, this is the first book that's kind of specifically pegged to the centenary of World War One to make the bestseller list, and not a history, but a novel.
Which leads us unnaturally into the next book.
Yeah, a book that is not set around the centenary of World War One. Ian Dosher, who has had a couple of bestsellers now with Shakespearean versions of the Star Wars movies, has now come back with the third Star Wars movie, Return of the Jedi. In iambic pentameter, new at number 12, we have William Shakespeare's The Jedi Doth Return. I believe this will conclude his Shakespeare's Star Wars trilogy. I talked to him a couple of years ago when William Shakespeare's Star Wars came out, and he told me that he had no intention of doing movies 4, 5, and 6, or 1, 2, 3.
No Phantom Menace.
No Phantom
Doth Menace. Okay.
No Jar Jar Binks, I think, is more to the point. Then at number 11, Jojo Moyes, who has a couple of books over on the trade paperback list, has a new book out in the same vein as her earlier stuff. It's sort of a mismatched romance. It's called One Plus One, and it's about a kind of a grumpy tech billionaire who comes to the rescue of a single mom and her kids. And then finally, the last new book on the hardcover fiction list this week is by Dean Koontz. That's new at number 5. It's called The City. Koontz, of course, well known as a horror novelist. He's been a standard of the list going back decades. But in the last couple of books that he's written, he's sort of changed his whole approach to novels. This is not a horror novel. It's almost like a fairy tale. He's kind of taken an allegorical turn in his fiction. There's kind of a fairy godmother type figure in this book. And it's got this very kind of nostalgic feel. It's about a musician who's the son of a famous musician and the grandson of a famous musician. And he's now kind of finding himself as an artist. It's about his relationship with the city where he lives.
Okay. Not much movement in nonfiction?
No, only one new title on the nonfiction side of things this week. That is new at number 7. It's by the comedian and TV host Joan Rivers. It's a book called Diary of a Mad Diva. It is, in fact, or it purports to be, in fact, a diary. It's set out with daily entries in which she kind of tells you what's going on in her life, but uses it as the opportunity to make a lot of raunchy, politically incorrect jokes.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.